Friday is arrived. Friday is upon us. What a week it has been. And it's going to show. You have no idea how happy I am that Friday's here. Workday's not quite over for me. Got a radio show and an appearance on Fox Business. It's, 6:40 Eastern time tonight. So look out for all of that. Go fight the good fights on Fox, as I will, concerning the president's Latin American trip, I think is part of the topic, among other interesting battles. So what's 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program, as usual. It's Friday. We've got lots going on. Usually Fridays are a little more fun. Yes, we'll deal with some substance. There's some news, some updates as far as the auto companies. GM's CEO gave some updates. We'll be talking a little bit about that and what it means, the surgical bankruptcy. A lot of listener emails about my my analogy with Independence Day being about and that the asteroid to the center of the or nuclear weapon to the center of the asteroid as an analogy. So we'll get to that and lots of your emails in the program. But it's Friday, and I so look forward to a Friday at 3 o'clock because I get to speak to my dear friend and boy toy James Boyce, who's one of the top bloggers over at Huffington Post and a former senior advisor to John Kerry and Bill Richardson. And he's here with us. Hi, James.
Every Friday, Nancy. It shouldn't come as a surprise. I'm here every Friday.
I know.
3 o'clock. I'm here for you.
You are you are a rock, dude. And that is so important to me because these are turbulent times, rough waters. So it's so good to have that reliable boy toy action. how are you, James? Good week.
Good.
For you?
How are you?
Good. It just seems like such a long week because the tea parties were a big deal. I mean, things are going faster now than they have in a long time. But I guess we had the pre-tea party coverage, the tea parties, the fallout, and so many other like real events going on in addition to these three ring circuses. That it just seems like it's been a long week. Tea parties. Now I'm reading on Huffington Post that there's some polling, some reaction that it could have backfired, that it turned independents off. Really? Go figure.
Yeah. Who knew?
What was your take of the whole tea party extravaganza, James?
Well, it was interesting. There are a couple things about it, Nancy. I'm out in Los Angeles, and I was at an event last night with Harry Reid out here, and it came up. And, you know, I think the consensus is it's fascinating to me because, you know, I think Democrats initially dismissed it. It's a perfect example of what the Republicans do is they don't really worry about the facts because having a Tea Party, even with what they're saying, doesn't really make any sense against what's, you know, being from Boston, what the original Tea Party was all about. You know, and you can't, and I know this from my work online, and in politics, you can't create a grassroots movement. I mean, you can have a couple events and you can get some people to show up, but you really can't create a grassroots movement. And they tried to kind of create a grassroots movement from top down. And I think in the end, it didn't work very well. And I think part of it was because it doesn't really make sense. You know what they're talking about. It doesn't really make sense in the end. And
right.
It might have some initial appeal, but the more you look at it, I think it does fall pretty flat. There is a nice article in the Huffington Post by Sam Stein about it, and I just don't think it works very well.
Well, you know, it's sort of we're living in parallel realities because I've also seen some Newt Gingrich and these guys think it was the rebirth of the conservative movement. So, can we really be operating off of those completely different? That's like Unix. two different operating systems of thinking. We're looking at them laughing. My gig on that day was what was funnier, the teabaggers or the YouTubers? Because YouTube is pretty exciting this week too, with Lindsay Lohan and the woman from American Idol. Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah, 47-year-old woman who'd never been kissed.
Oh, yeah.
Belted out this tune from Les Mis and something like 5 million YouTube hits from that. So I think the YouTube people were more entertained by the YouTube, although the teabagging with the innuendo, I mean, that's priceless.
Yeah.
So
well, I think they said they're going to go, you know, try another round in July. I don't know. I mean, I do think the Democrats would make a mistake if you totally dismissed it, you know, because there is anger out there. And what the Republicans are really trying to do, Nancy, is they're trying to tap into the anger that's out there. And there is substantial anger. You know, since we spoke last week, there was the issue of the right-wing extremism, the Homeland Security saying that may come up. But there is real anger in America. I mean, these people that have lost their jobs, lost their houses, lost their savings, you know, they're mad. And really all the Republicans are trying to do is channel that anger towards the Democrats. And if you look at that as their goal, then they did have some success.
Yeah.
You know, they did have some success.
Well,
but that's going to be their strategy in 2000, maybe in 2010, but really in 2012, is you ought to be angry at the Democrats because they have the White House, they have the Senate, they have the House, and the country's still in trouble. And that's really all the Tea Party thing is about, is trying to get people angry at Democrats.
Right, and well, the great irony here, and also the handicap, is that, as you pointed out, James, there's a legitimate cause for the anger and anxiety in the country from the financial standpoint, but who caused it? I mean, we got to this point because of huge tax cuts, deregulation, all this leveraging, you know, the two wars and how expensive they were. These guys buckle out of town. We're the janitors cleaning it up and getting blamed. It's like blaming the AAA guy who's pulling you out of the ditch for the accident.
Saying, you know, why'd you put the ditch there? I mean, Harry Reid started his comments last night at this event in Los Angeles, you know, talking about how, you know, no president should ever have had to inherit the mess and the scale and the breadth of the problems that Barack Obama was given. And I totally agree with that. And I do think, Nancy, you know, and you and I kind of go back and forth a little bit on this, but I do think that's one of the dangers of just saying, there's an interesting post on Huffington Post today by someone saying, look, you know, so these crimes were committed by people in Washington, so they don't matter, so they don't get prosecuted, so we let the torture issue and all these other issues just kind of go. And I wonder if we look back on it in a couple of years, if we're not going to wish that we didn't push a little harder on holding the Republicans accountable for the last 8 years from a public relations point of view of making sure the American people do understand whose fault it is. And that's why I do think there might be some merit in the people that are out there saying, look, you know, you can move forward, but at the same time, you better hold these people accountable because, you know, the American public's going to forget pretty quick.
Well, okay, I think there's a little, and this will be a big topic today we're going to get into. Two different issues, though, in terms of the torture and the memos released yesterday that details it and the Obama decision not to prosecute CIA officials who were essentially ordered to do this. That's different, I think, James, than the idea that what Conyers is talking about, the actually going in and seeing if they violated the Constitution and what Cheney and his group did and having those open hearings. I tend to agree with you that that stuff is, we have to bring that out in the open, whether there's criminal prosecutions, probably. It's, for me, it was always about timing of it, that right now we have to get past this economic meltdown a little bit, and it's not the first thing you do. It wasn't that we shouldn't hold them responsible, it's that we have a bus coming at us called this global meltdown, and you can only do so much. You know, in media, there's only so much oxygen. And so are you going to use that to save yourself, or are you going to use it to, you know, to put them down? Now, how do you feel about the CIA? Now, that's, to me, different. If you're working for the CIA and you believe that this is, you're being told these techniques are what you have to do, what would you do as a CIA agent who was told you had to do whatever some of these gross techniques we're finding out? We put insects in the coffin or whatever where this guy was.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, there's two things about it. It's obviously a very difficult decision. And, you know, it's a decision that I can't really say what I would do because, you know, I'm not a CIA agent, I'm not a thing. However, there is a legal precedent that says that if you are asked to do something that is clearly illegal, that you have an obligation not to do it. And that's an international law precedent, it's a domestic law precedent. So I think it's a very tough call. I'm not saying that'd be an easy thing to do. But, you know, the precedent is if you know it's illegal and you do it, you are liable.
Yeah, but they were being told that it was not. That's the only that throw that confusion factor in the whole thing. That's really a mess.
Oh, absolutely. Not taking Chris Hook's their case at all.
Yeah, it's a tough one. All right, hey, we got past the torture. Let's talk about Texas seceding from the Union.
Pray God if they do.
I got some poll numbers on that. And
how do we make that happen?
we're for it.
Refer.
We have we have a lot of friends down there in Texas. We had
they can still visit.
We got to help out our friends who are sane in Texas. So we'll talk about it. James Boyce, my boy toy on Friday, is with me going through some of the news of the week. And you can always join the conversation at 1-888-64-NANCY. That's 1-888-0-NANCY as well, or 646-2629. If you don't have those letters on your phone, 1-888-646-2629 and the Nancy Skinner Show. Show 1-888-646-2629 with James Boyce, my boy toy on Fridays from Huffington Post, blogger extraordinaire. James, before we move along to our other topics, Joel from Venice Beach wants to weigh in on the teabagging controversy before we change topics. So let's get Joel in here. Hi, Joel.
Hey, Nancy. How are you?
Oh, I'm just terrific.
Great. Let me just first say I really appreciate your moderated voice, because it's so easy to get really angry from my perception at the stupidity of what I see the extremely right-wing extremists are doing. So I really appreciate your mitigation of that anger, even while I'm seething.
I do my best.
Yeah, you do very well. What I want to say is that I was watching Janine Garofalo yesterday on MSNBC on Keith Olbermann, and she's the only person who I had heard come straight out and say it flat out what I saw when I saw McCain campaigning in Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania. I'm from Philadelphia, although I live in California. And that is that the base, the right, the Republicans and what I view as the teabaggers are white racists. They're furious. I didn't see any brown people, red people, or yellow people in those crowds of teabaggers the other day. And it just confirms what I view as all the blather about this teabagging is a disguise for the anger of a certain group of people in this country who cannot accept the fact that the population has diversified, that it's expanded, and that they are becoming more and more irrelevant. I mean, the extreme right wing.
Well, you know, I saw Janine last night on with Keith. I saw the segment that you're talking about, and I have to say, I thought she was over the top when she, because she kind of what she did. I agree that I think that that's one element of the that there is that just this was a mix of people with the various complaints, but that and there certainly was people that didn't want to see a black president. There certainly are racists that are angry, and that whatever percent, who knows? The fact that you didn't see people of color probably is because most people of color tend to be more moderate to left than, far, far right wing. You just don't have that. But where I think she went over the top for me, Joel, was she basically said all Republicans are racists. And she would interchange conservatives with racists with GOP. And she was...
I agree with you. That is not true. I know some fine Republican people.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about the teabaggers, the people who showed up to somehow blame Obama for the package and the way that the Democrats are dealing with the extraordinary financial crisis that we're in. And what I saw, aside from extreme extremists, were that portion of the Republican Party that really is racist, period. That's what I suppose.
Well,
go ahead, James.
No, well, I mean, I think the difference is very important. I do think, you know, as I said on MSNBC, Nancy, as you know, a week ago, and actually, interesting enough, Arnold Schwarzenegger said something very similar to the LA Times the other day. There is a segment of the Republican Party that I do believe is essentially racist, but it's not the whole Republican Party. It's not anywhere near a majority of the Republican Party, but there is a small segment that does exist. And, you know, there's segments of the Democratic Party that might not be that attractive, but there is a segment of the Republican Party that does not want a black president, and you did see some of that reflected in the Tea Party.
Well, I totally agree with you, but once again, as the Republican Party shrinks, who's left? You know?
Well, you know, that's what they're grappling with.
I totally get it. I mean, I completely get it.
Yeah. But, Joel, I think, you know, I think there's truth to it. But I thought Janine, I had to say, she's, I was like, whoa, way, way over the top. And I think sometimes that could be, just like the Tea Party thing, there's going to be a backlash for them. When we have blanket statements like that, say things like that, I think there's also backlash there. Because there are white Democrat races, too. But let's face it.
There is your moderate voice that I so appreciate.
All right, Joel. Hey, thanks a lot. We appreciate you calling in. Okay.
Thank you.
All right,
okay,
great.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right. James, hold on. We will get to Texas and all the other controversies here with my boy toy, James Weiss, on a Friday on the Nancy Skinner Show.
Sleep every wheel again, baby. You're drifting over the line, yeah. Your hands are tied, but you're losing grip quickly. Fix me, can you read the signs? Thumbing your way to Vegas, dirty, and dreaming on the other side.
All right. On the front lines, I am, it seems, on a Friday on the Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY. James Boyce is with me. James, I'm going to just call you my friend right now. James, I'm getting mad. I'm going to share this with you, and you can talk me down, okay?
Okay.
I just got an email from, who is this? Dimitri writes in, calling me a Republican apologist. Nancy, Janine Garofalo's comments we're way over the top? Really? I don't agree. If you saw any of the clips in the comments of these morons, you know that this is pure racism. It is because you, in capital letters, are Republican light. You pretend to be a progressive. I now will never listen to your show again. Now, I have to tell you that, listen to what Janine said on the show. Okay, and I am what I am, and I just think this is so ridiculous to get these emails. She got on that show last, and I know Janine, I like her, and you know, I find her to be very funny, but this is what she said last night. Let's be very honest about what this is about. This is not about bashing Democrats. It's not about taxes. They have no idea what the Boston Tea Party was about. They don't know their history at all. It's about hating a black man in the White House, she said. This is racism straight up and nothing but a bunch of teabagging rednecks. There is no way around that. Keith did not stop or challenge any of these statements that she made on the air. She went on to describe the brain size of a typical right-winger Republican, and not just conservatives. She's saying Republicans, okay? So that's a different thing. When you're taking a whole party of people and saying a right-winger Republican or conservative or your average white power activist. She said their synapses are misfiring. It is a neurological problem we are dealing with. Now, I am, and then she went on to say something, I don't know, going on. Now, I'm sorry. If Dimitri, if you heard my coverage of the tea bags, I said how ridiculous I think it was, that they were completely off the mark, whatnot. If you want me to be filled with as much hate as they are, then I am not your friend. You should not listen to me. If you want me to be that hate-filled and you want me to call every Republican racist and say that that's all that was about, then don't listen to me. Because I think that when we are just as bad as they are, when we are that filled with hate, that we are going to take half of this country and say they are all racist and they're all, there's confusion, they are wrong on the issues, and then to challenge my politics, who have run for office, who've been an activist working on these issues for as long as I can remember, to have my own politics challenge because I say to people, look it, we can't do what they do. We can't blanket these people. And if you're going to do that, and that's what you want, if you want that hate, Dimitri, you don't want to be angry and hate-filled, then you are no better than them. That's, yeah. So talk me down, because obviously I'm not in a good place.
Okay, get it. I just want to ask John to make sure there's no sharp objects in the room around you. But here's the thing, Nancy, is that, I mean, you're correct. I mean, Jeanine Garofalo went over the top on that. You know, what you did see in the Tea Parties, you did see a lot of racism on display, unfortunately. You did see that. However, that's a small segment.
Is every Republican a racist? Because
no,
I know
of course
lots
not.
Of Republicans who are not racist.
No, of course not. And the thing is that, you know, it's a little bit of, it's a bad way to fight the battle on a lot of levels. Certainly you have the Democratic credibility. I mean, I know that you didn't, you know, put your life on the line and raise money and make all those, you know, crappy fundraising calls to run for office and try to serve this country as an elected Democratic official. I know you didn't do that, and anybody with any logic in their brain would know that you didn't do that.
Who supported gay marriage when it wasn't popular to do it. Who
right.
started talking about global warming before it was when we were wackos. Who pioneered progressive radio, one of the first back in 1997. I was the first one showing up at every, Dimitri, at every talk radio conference saying we need to have our voices out there. So how dare you challenge me because I don't hate as much as the other side. Because that's the solution to hate isn't hate, my friend. The solution to hate is wisdom and logic and reason. And it
well,
is not
and,
that.
And Nancy, there's another part about it. Let me interrupt so you don't get too high. You don't have to jump from too high a perch. I mean, there's another part of it. There is a time and there is a place to be strong in politics, okay? And there is a time and place to make declarative statements. However, you know, when you make declarative statements that are wrong, you know, it's a little bit of the boy crying wolf syndrome. And unfortunately, you know, the Tea Parties, they are what they were. They are. They were a micro segment of the Republican Party. It brought out a lot of very discontented wackos. You know, my friend Marco said, this is why I don't like on-the-street protests, because it brings out the wackos. And that's what it did.
Yes.
And that's what it was. Now, do the
and
Republicans
that's what I said on my show that whole day.
I get to go a second. It's your show, but I get to go. But, you know, do the Republicans own those people that were at the Tea Parties? Oh, absolutely. Are they part of the Republican Party? Absolutely. Are they part of what's wrong with the Republican Party? Completely. But are they representational of the entire Republican Party and all conservatives? No, of course not.
And is that how you're going to, for those people who are confused by the spinning that goes on the other side, James, and the confusion that's thrown at them, is the way to really win them over to just blanket throw hate and call them racists and do things? Do you think, Dimitri, really, that we're going to have an impact on this country if we do exactly what they do? You know, I mean, do you think that's effective? Do you think that's how you're going to advance your own cause? If that, you know, to me, it sounds like she just wants, you want more hate? You know, you can find it. It's out there. I just choose not to embrace it on a day-to-day basis. And when I just get a whole flurry of that.
Did you live in Texas, Nancy?
Nowhere. I don't know where she lives.
But no, then if Texas secedes, we don't have a problem.
Yeah, all right. Well, I apologize for that. I don't often lose my cool, as you know. On the show, as Joel just said, I try to keep it at a certain thing. But when you just get enough people that want you to be filled with hate and that they're going to feel better if I'm a monster and I just hate everybody, that's not in my making. I don't think it's effective. I do think that there are people, if you listen to my whole coverage of the whole Tea Parties, I think that there are people who are anxious. They've lost their jobs. That the Republicans, the Newt Gingriches of the world, the Dick Armies, they harness that anxiety. They use fear and those kind of tactics to get those people, but that doesn't mean that if we do it, you know, that we should do it as well. It does not mean that. It doesn't. It makes you this. It puts you on the same level as they are.
Right.
That's it. So, anyways, let's see. Let's get Bob in here. He has a comment to make about this. Hi, Bob.
Hi, I was just driving home. I was listening to the comment about with the economic environment. Now is not the time to go into torture and investigating in general the Bush administration. And I wish people would look at it from a different angle and question the timing of the economic problems and all the problems that faced Barack Obama, that these can almost appear to be smoke screens and well-timed events to prevent the investigation of these kind of things.
So the global economic meltdown was planned somehow. All this was planned so that Obama would have his hands so busy trying to get us out of a depression that he couldn't investigate their war crimes.
If the ability was there to do it, would they do it?
So somehow you think that the Bush administration planned all the credit default swap manipulations that created the foreclosure crisis and all that was sort of orchestrated at Cheney's office. I am saying they are responsible for this global economic meltdown without a doubt.
Okay.
But I don't think that it was done as cover for potential future prosecutions. I think it was done because they were greedy and had friends in high places who did not want to be regulated, and they had a blind eye to all of this mischievousness that was going on.
If you stand back and you look at the big picture, we don't know how deep the misdeeds were over 8 years yet, and how this would fit into a master plan of regaining power in 4 years if they can keep Obama backed into a corner with all these things to deal with that he couldn't fight his way out of. It looks like a pretty good plan to me.
What do you think, James? Grand conspiracy theory to melt down the global economy so that your war crimes couldn't be prosecuted, and you'd have to do a lot of work if with the intent of causing a global meltdown for the fact that you would have some public cover so that you couldn't be prosecuted for your war crimes.
But Nancy, war crimes could be the beginning. We don't know the depth. And I don't think that 9/11 has been fully investigated to the degree that it should be that caused all of this stuff.
Okay, let's let James answer. I don't like these guys, and I was one of their worst critics, but I think these super conspiracy theories that would go this far, just, you know what? Go ahead, James.
No, I do believe at some point that they were packing up the White House. Somebody probably did have the thought, you know, I bet we don't get investigated because we're leaving such a big mess, we'll spend all their time fixing it. I would believe that to be true.
That's not what Bob was saying, though. Bob was saying
that
there was a plan to...
No, but I don't think that anybody sat back and said, you know, wow, if we create the largest asset bubble in the history of man and it pops right when we leave office, we're scot free. I don't think that's true.
No, I don't think they're smart enough for that, frankly, to have that level of sophistication.
Well, you just don't have that much control, and I think that the tragic thing is, like Dick Cheney really thought that the Americans were going to go into Baghdad and people were going to throw flowers at us and welcome us as liberators, you know, they didn't really think that a lot of things they were doing were going to destroy the economy and the country. I mean, they believed in them and passionately, and unfortunately, that's why they took them so far to the point that they did. But I don't think they would do it in an attempt to cover up crimes. I think there are crimes there, but I don't think the global meltdown was manipulated to create crimes, to cover up crimes.
Because if you did, James, I don't know. What a crazy...
Come back, as you know.
It's turning into a pretty crazy Friday, I can tell already. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program. If you want me to be angrier, meaner, and more conspiracy-filled.
If somebody could send in a right-wing plant email, then we could really get you going.
Right, obviously. And I get lots of them. It's just hitting the wrong spot today. James, we will talk about Texas and lots of other things here in our last segment. I'll let you take over and make me feel better. Stop me from jumping off the cliff.
Don't jump off the cliff.
No, I can. I got a 3-hour radio show. Hold on. 1-888-64-NANCY, number of the program. appropriate song. On a Friday on the Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY with James Boyce, my friend and boy toy on this crazy Friday. Is it like, is there some sort of event going on? Are we in Mercury retrograde or something? Because we've got a lot of people who are angry. I mean, almost the anger on the left. And here's what James, let me just wrap this up real quick. I know we got a bunch of people online, but, you know, I just think that here's a risk. If you look at the numbers, 66% approval rating of Obama and the disapproval of the Republican parties at like, their approval is like 20-something percent, 5%. It's the lowest ever. Uh-huh. We can overreact to their antics. You know what I mean? When we build them up and we spend all our time searching out and finding their antics and talking about them, we're making them so much bigger than they deserve based on where middle America is. They support the president. I just saw this poll that says only 53% say capitalism is better than socialism.
Isn't that wild?
Yes. They want, I also saw another poll, they want the government to be big government. They are happy that he's taking these steps right now. So are we just codependent in that we need to have this like overreaction to the fringe right, and then that makes our fringe left look worse to the independents who we really need?
Well, I think you're right about that. I mean, I do think that both parties play to the fringes, you know, when attacking the party. And what I mean by that is when the Republicans attack Democrats, they don't attack the core of Democrats. They'll attack people on the far left. When the Democrats attack Republicans, they'd like to go to the far right and use them as examples of the whole party. So I think you are correct. And what's amazing to me is the numbers have been very consistent. They're often up on DailyCoast.com, and Marcos does polling, and it's very consistent that really only about, 17-18% of Americans approve of the Republican Party and what the Republicans are doing. So despite all of what they're doing and the Democratic reaction to it, they aren't really getting any traction so far with their efforts.
All right, let's get Randall here in Buffalo wants to jump in the middle, he says, between us and the previous caller. Hi, Randall.
Hi, Nancy. Thank you again for taking my call. Listen, when you think of a couple of things, first off, I think people are really exhaling right now and venting because the release of these memos have proven a lot of people correct that have been calling out for this kind of oversight for years and being completely laughed off and ignored. Second point, fascism is what that government was going for, Bush and Cheney. They were going for fascism. And they came very close to it. If you read the articles of the 16 points of fascism, one of them is you destroy the middle class, give all the money to the wealthy, you tank the economy if you can, so now people need the government to step in, and just like Hitler did, now you can go and, have the legislature pass anything you want because the people are so weak because they're unemployed and dependent on the government. I'm just saying, they didn't necessarily create the economic bubble, but, when they saw this opportunity coming along, they didn't do anything to stop it. They completely ignored it.
You know what? That's greed, Randall. That was pure greed that was untapped and unchecked and allowed that to happen.
Right. But let me say one more thing. Listen, when you consider 9/11 happened on the one day in 50 years that NORAD turned themselves off and did an exercise on what? An exercise on hijackers hijacking airplanes and running them into buildings. That one very same day, those hijackers took those airplanes, and that's why no plane was scrambled to intercept them. Cheney knew those things, and he was the one running it. And he looked the other way.
All right, Randall, I don't get into 9/11 conspiracy theories. I just don't believe that I'll get it from this. Here's my email, nancy@nancyskinnerlive.com. Go ahead, come at me. Do I think, and I despise Dick Cheney, despise him, but do I think he wanted and allowed and orchestrated the attack on Americans that killed that many Americans? No, absolutely not. I think he is a man who's filled with who believes that he's right and that he was so obsessed with his own greed. But do I think that he's a mass murderer? I do not, Randall. And I, if that makes me a bad progressive host or I'm not whatever, then I guess that's it. I just don't think anyone, I don't believe that anyone in power would seek to destroy American lives and have a massive attack on our country. And James, do you, does that make me not qualified to be, you know, on the left? Do I have to say that? Because I can't say that because I don't believe it. I don't believe anybody is that mean or hate-filled.
No, you're still a good Democrat, Nancy. Don't worry.
Unless I say I think Dick Cheney orchestrated 9/11. You know, if you just want red meat people, just pure red meat, you can find it. But that's not going to get us anywhere, I think. James, I'm sorry. We usually have more fun than this on a Friday.
I know.
This is a bummer. We'll regroup. And next week?
We'll try again. Next week, more Lindsay Lohan, less 9/11 conspiracy.
Let's do that. Okay.
Always, take care of yourself,
always a pleasure, James Boyce from the Huffington Post. All right. 1-888-64-NANCY on Freaky Friday. Dad would say, you know, buckle up. It is the Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY, number of the program. finding myself on this Friday embroiled in a big controversy about how hot my heat meter should be. Lots of emails, people saying because I thought Janine, if you're just tuning in, Janine Garofalo, who I admire, but I think she was over the top yesterday on Keith Olbermann when she said all Republicans were racist. I think that was over the top. Do I think racism? Do I think that there were racists at those things? Absolutely. At those rallies, certainly I do. But do I think that all Republicans are racist? No, I don't. And I'm sorry. And if that's where I'm getting some email from, I got her name wrong. And then she wrote me back to tell me how wrong I got her name. And I've just talked to a friend of mine during the break. I said, hey, listen, you know, if people want me to be a hate monger, if that's the product you want, it's just to hate as much as the other side hates, because there's a lot of hate. They work out of hate and fear on the other side. I can't be that person. First of all, Obama President Obama won this election, and he didn't do that. Okay? He did not engage in that sort of behavior. So the idea that we have to be as hate-filled as they are or can be, even their radical elements, and of course there are racists. But do I think all Republicans are racist? No, I do not. And you know what? So for the callers, and I had a lot of people calling in, and they're mad, and then, you know, we need you to be meaner, and, you know, whatever, you want me to do that? I'm going to read you an email I got yesterday, okay? Tanya, this is before today, before all this stuff happened. Tanya writes in, and she says, "Dear Nancy, a quick note of encouragement you can share with anyone you think might benefit. Sometimes I like to torture myself and turn my radio dial to 620 AM KPOJ, but I can't stand there." That's in Portland, our great affiliate there. "But I can't stay there long because the hate and intolerance of all those hosts I've heard, which are only a handful, are too much. I'm not a talk radio junkie, but I'm in my car quite a bit, so I tune in to a host of programs, but I'm not a big fan of any of them. That's just a little history. Here's what I want to communicate. I was in my car and tuned into 620, and I heard a very small portion of your interview with a woman named Claudia. Anyway, I was so impressed with your demeanor and your gracious way of asking her tough questions and have her back up what she was claiming. Unfortunately, I had to go in the store at the point where you and she were talking about the effects of George Bush's overthrow of Hussein. Just for disclosure, I am the last big fan of President Bush, which I gathered you are not. After I was done shopping, I turned you back on and caught the end of a letter from Reggie, who was complaining that you aren't tough enough. Anyways, that was my take. I think we have all had enough of the discourse and arguing. Let's work together and stop yelling at each other. I would encourage you to keep being open and fair-minded and asking intelligent questions without being hostile, and you will gain more fans from the quote-unquote evil right. You might have to worry about the left, though. They seem to like an echo chamber. Knowing quite a few conservatives, I can tell you they are more open and fair-minded than any progressive I have heard or come across." I will beg to differ with her on that point. The only time radio hosts on a network, she's talking about liberal network, are open-minded is when you agree with their agenda. And anyone who has a different agenda, they explode all over them. Or worse yet, rant, rant, rant. Let's see. I can't really determine, or just scheduling. She says that she wants to find out where I am on the radio dial. She lives in just outside of Portland. That is if you're looking to build an audience that is more diverse. Sorry, get this point, folks. Sorry I was a little harsh with my feelings about the progressives, and which is not your problem. It is mine. Sincerely, Tanya. Okay, folks, now these are the kinds of emails. So I can get Demetra, who thinks I'm not hate-filled enough, and because I will not call every Republican racist, that's not good enough for her. This is the kind of person, when I talk about hearts and minds, the last person to vote for Bush, is listening to a show, a host, obviously I am a Democrat, obviously very progressive in my viewpoints, thank you, and have been taking really tough stands, like nationalization, gay marriage, the environment for a long time. But if I am not sort of filled up with hatred while I'm delivering that, what's so wrong with that? Because what's going to happen is Tanya's going to start listening to this program, and more Tanyas like her. And progressive radio, let's face it, folks, it's a small market compared to right-wingers all across the spectrum. They have hundreds, 500-600 stations. And so I think that when they used hate, great, that worked for them. Does that mean that we have to use hate and that's going to work for us? That's not how Obama got elected. I don't believe it's going to be, it's not good in terms of just living our lives. It is just not a positive place of being to be hate-filled all the time. Secondly, it's not effective. You're not going to win people over. You're not going to build bigger audiences who will listen. She's a Republican. This Claudia interview I was talking about was a woman from North Korea. She was talking about North Korea. And she wrote this article in Forbes.com about how we got to be tougher. We got to, we can't just have words. We need action. So I was really questioning her. Well, what do you mean by that? Are you talking about, she said, well, maybe we need those sharpshooters. I go, are you talking about assassination? And I was really holding her feet to the fire, and really her whole argument imploded. It was just another, we're not tough enough piece. But when I asked her specifically, well, then tell me what you're saying, it fell apart. Now, a fair-minded person is going to listen to that interview and say, well, you know what, she dealt with someone in a non-hostile manner, but she beat him. That's more effective to me than having the amen crowd just shout to each other and you know, go nowhere, build no following, change no hearts and minds. And I constantly get these, you know, I get a lot of people, thank you, who write in and they appreciate this and they say they're so happy because we need to do this. But I can't tell you the people that I get, like Dimitri, who are so angry that I'm not angrier. You don't think I get angry? I've spent my life in politics. I have, to see, when I see reports on the Arctic and the situation that's going on and the battles we've had to fight, but it wasn't a guy who came hate-filled to the scene that changed the world. It was a guy who said, you know, there's a better way at this, okay? So for all these people that are sick of me, let's see, Steve is sick of me defending racist Republicans, it says on my screen. I'm not saying, Steve, I am not saying that there aren't racists. I am just saying if you think all Republicans are racist, then maybe you got to examine your own view. And if you think honestly that there aren't Democrats who are white racists, I mean, you know, we were the party of Dixie. So, you know, these whole categories that you're plopping people into aren't necessarily accurate. Do you understand what I'm saying, Steve? Steve. He's not on the line. All right, let's go to John, then, in Los Angeles. Hi, John.
Hi. Look, I love your show. And I agree with you. If racism is everything, then racism is nothing. But in California, what we did when we were with for two propositions which had a very racist effect, 187 and 209, in 1994, Democrats in California were facing a Republican governor and a majority for the first time in a long time of a majority in our state assembly. The only place we had a majority was in the California State Senate. And what we did was we left the logic to the court arguments, but we appealed to an emerging minority state on the basis of emotion, an emotion which could trump the emotion of fear which animated 187 and 209. And that emotion was, we will treat you as human beings. And we made Pete Wilson the bugaboo. And we didn't use any charged language, but when Democrats went into minority communities and we said Pete Wilson, the African Americans, who were 7% of the population, the Latinos itself, who were 42% of the population, the Asian Pacific Islanders, who were 10% of the population, the Filipinos, who were 3% of the population, over 60% of the people knew what was behind 187 and 209. And what we did was we used a positive emotion to defeat a negative emotion. And what's really interesting is Republicans...
And it worked, right? And it worked, John? It worked.
It worked. We have become the bluest of the blue states by using emotion, not just logic. There's a place for both.
I agree. I agree with you. Absolutely. Emotion is more powerful than logic. And that's been Democratic because they campaign on a whole list of issues. And, you know, I believe that it really is emotional, but they've been using fear and we've been using logic. So the Trump card is not to use fear and hate and play their game. It is to up them by using positive emotions and, you know, making us feel good. So even if it's about patriotism, you know, that's a good positive emotion. It can be. They have used it in a negative way.
Nancy, here's something for our Trekkies, and I'm a Trekkie. Spark is a Democrat. McCoy is a Republican. Because McCoy only used emotion and Spock only used logic, and Captain Kirk had to moderate between the two of them.
Okay. Well, there you have it.
There you have it.
That settles the whole debate. John, thanks a lot. I appreciate you giving us a...
I appreciate your show.
Thank you. A tough Friday for me. My goodness. Wow. Coming at me from every angle. Hang on. If you're on the lines, we're going to get back to you. 1-888-64-NANCY. That's 1-888-646-2629. If you have a comment about my level of hate or lack thereof, for whether it's effective or not, I guess I just got rid of my guests. Said forget it. I can't. I can't even talk cars right now because we're in the middle of this whole thing. So I'll just be honest with you. This upsets me. It really does because I think hard. I really do. I feel and think about this when I do this. And so, you know, it's important to me to hear how you feel when we actually have these discussions. Because that's what this is all about. Sledding for me today, because it's sort of all about me, I guess, today, and whether I made one comment. I thought Janine Garofalo was over the top on her statements referring to all. She interchanged words saying all Republicans were racist, and I just didn't agree with that. I think the Tea Parties, there was racism, obviously, and there is that element. But I think when we do what they do, we're no better. Let's get Patricia on from Sacramento. Hi, Patricia.
Hey, Nancy. Bear with me here because I just got back from the dentist. So.
Oh, that's okay. Go for it.
Yeah, one side of my mouth is still paralyzed here. But the girl that wrote you, the girl or gentleman who wrote you that email, I don't think they're a true progressive. I'm a big fan of your show, and I'm also a big fan of the Tom Hartman show. And the reason is that both shows don't spew hate. You know, mm-hmm. You don't go after people and say all Christians are extremists and all Muslims are terrorists. It's doing the same thing that the right does, which is labeling everybody into one category.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want to tie to this is that, you know, in the past there have been some decent Republicans. Look, Richard Nixon was terrible with the Watergate scandal. But if people look at his domestic policies, he was more to the left than our Democrats today.
Didn't he start the EPA? I'm just reading the book about the Nixons because of Ed Nixon's coming on the show. So,
yeah, I mean, President Eisenhower, who warned us about the military-industrial complex, these mm-hmm. were great Republicans as far as their policies and their beliefs in helping the working class. So I ask people, don't label everybody in the same category. It's not fair. I mean, I know Democrats. My mom lives in Fort Lauderdale, and she has a couple of friends that vote Democrat, but they are racist.
Yeah.
And I will tell you for a fact, so do not assume.
That's what I was trying to do, and... You know, Tom and I are good friends. We go way back and love his program as well. And, you know, I think he's got the same approach. And, hey, it's about hearts and minds. But
yes, tolerance. We have to have tolerance. Otherwise, we become just like them.
Yep.
Thanks for taking my call, Nancy.
Thanks, Patricia. We appreciate that. More of your calls coming up because I got other ones who really want to let go on me, too. Why not? I guess I'm fair game. Put myself on the radio. 1-888-64-NANCY. That's 1-888-646-2620. Oh my, on a very strange Friday.
I went to the doctor, I went to the mountains, I looked to the children, I drank from the fountains. There's more than one answer to these questions.
Just get it over with, although I don't know that it will go away. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm Nancy Skinner. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program. That's 646-2629. We are having this, discussion about race and tenor and tone. I got an email from, I'm getting lots of emails. I'm going to get right back to your phone calls, too. Richard writes in, because I want to be very clear about what we're talking about. He said, I voted for Obama. I'm a devout Democrat. I do not believe Keith Olbermann
and Janine Garofalo think all Republicans are racists. I want to be clear about this. I did not say that. Okay, I said I thought Janine Garofalo was over the top last night when she said, and I'll pull that report back up, when she basically said all Republicans are racist, that the teabags parties had nothing to do with anything other than race, and this was all Republican racism. Now, and then I'm going to read you another email from Reggie, who started this discussion to begin with, by sending me an email. Let me just say this, as I was thinking over the break. There are racists out there. Reggie says he's afraid I keep running from the issue of race. It's not that I'm running from the issue of race, Reggie. What I don't do is I don't feed that. I know Reggie had called and wanted to talk about the risk to the president's life or anything. I don't feed that. I don't feed energy to that, okay? Because that's... I just believe that you should not feed into that negativity. It has a snowball effect. But when it comes to race, there are racists out there. But if you look at the two political parties and their sort of defining philosophy, I do believe there's a difference. That the Republican Party, they are more about me, and the Democrats traditionally have been about we. So it's the me versus we kind of philosophy, if you look at it. So, you know, it's so much easier to go after and sort of bring those racists into your fold when you can point a finger at somebody and say, this is the reason your life isn't working out. It's their fault. They want affirmative action. It's their fault. And when you scapegoat, that's when it's, you know, I must be that person, because it's so much easier to scapegoat. But there are racists who are Democrats, too. I mean, remember, was the party of Dixie. There are, and I would say that not young, I would say this is probably more an older generation. And I know these, I've seen these people. And they're white racists, too, and they're Democrats. Their issues are different than this. But I think that when you have someone who's racist, who's undereducated or unenlightened, it's so much easier for the GOP to use this tact and go after them to get them to come out to a teabag party, and you're going to see that. But those people are everywhere. I am not saying there aren't racists. That is not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that I think to blanket, I know Republicans, if you met my brother, I wouldn't say he's hardcore, but... You know, financial and economic issues and stuff like that, that's just how he identified. My brother is the most loving, generous person who has done more for more people and causes and doesn't flaunt it and would never have an act out there or talk about, you know, go to a tea party or anything insane like that. But there are lots of Republicans who are not racists. And I'm getting all these emails because, Garofalo's right, they're all racist and it's all a neurological disorder. That doesn't get us anywhere. Anywhere. You know, first of all, I think it's you are acting just like them when you say that. And it doesn't get us anywhere in terms of progress on any issues that we really care about. I mean, are you in this just for the Demetri who wrote me that email that was so hate-filled toward me? Are you in this just to feel better about yourself? Because, I mean, that's the key question. If you want to feel superior about your political philosophy or us versus them or whatever, then you know, you can use that because you'll get the same level of success. But are you going to change hearts and minds? Are you going to get like Tanya, who wrote me, who's a Republican who just happened to turn in and said, you know, I really appreciate the fact that you can have your point of view and that you could hold people to the fire, their feet to the fire, but not be hostile and hate-filled? Those are the people I want to bring into our fold. That's what, so we change hearts and minds. So we actually accomplish what it is we want to do. We've got a global warming people issue out there today. We've got all these big issues we have to solve. Do you think me sitting there screaming, calling all Republicans racist is going to help me achieve what I care the most about, which is getting a carbon cap and trade program and a global energy policy that makes sense so this planet doesn't go to hell? Do you think me calling someone racist helps in that at all? It does not. And if you want me to spill my guts on that, you got it. Because I don't think that's what the end game is. If you just want to feel better about yourself because we're morally superior, plenty of white Democratic racists as well. All right, I'm sorry. Let's go to... phones are lit up. Everyone's a little fired up, so let's just all take a deep breath and deal with it. John is in Los Angeles. John, thanks for holding on.
Oh, hi, Nancy. It's John, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, and it's a pleasure. Can I give you a brief bio and then ask why Democrats hate me and people like me?
Yeah, so you're a Republican?
I'm a Republican, and I would be labeled a conservative Republican.
Okay.
I struggle with my own business, a small business.
Let me ask before you go on, John. Why are you listening to me? I'm a Democrat.
I like to listen to all views.
Oh, okay.
And I would like some specific issues with you later, but you seem reasonable, and you seem like you at least have a loose grasp, so I thought I'd call in.
Sometimes I think you're right.
I'm kidding you. But as I said, I have a small business. I have a small family. My son literally risks his life to keep you and all Americans free and safe. I support on a monthly basis children in Africa. My church supports to the tune of literally millions of dollars AIDS research and cholera research in Africa. We support orphanages in Mexico.
Okay, so you're a good guy. Okay, you really do good works,
well,
right?
And the reason I say that, I can say that because you don't know who I am, and I'm not afraid. I personally contribute more than 10 times as a percentage of my income to charity than our vice president does, but I'll just toss that out there. Is it because I care more about an unborn child than I do about a lake slug that holds up a dam project that would give water to millions? I mean, what is it? Why am I here? Why does Paul Begala, Howard Dean, and Keith Olbermann, their spokesmen, not leaders, but Dean certainly is, why do they hate me? I don't understand it.
I don't
why
think
am
they
I
hate
racist? What makes me a racist?
I don't think that they hate you. I mean, I think the people you're talking
about. Howard Dean says that I don't care, and he said, you know, he said this. He thinks that I don't care about starving children. He said that very specifically. I'm a Republican.
No, well, I mean, if he said first of all, I know Howard Dean, and he usually doesn't employ language that broad, that Republicans don't care about starving children. If he did say that, then, you know, I would say that he misspoke, and he should.
Well, I'm quite sure, and I know he didn't misspeak.
No, but that's not his MO either. So, anyways, I think you're making my point, John. You're making my point in a lot of ways. That's why I had to fight back against those on the left that want me to say that you're a hate-filled racist monger. I don't believe
you doing that.
I think people are multidimensional, and I believe that there are, you know, we all have some. I'm sure everyone has some bit of racism in them at some point. I'm different degrees or whatnot, but nobody is any one thing. We are all human beings, and you could tend to have a philosophy whichever way it goes. I don't label people in huge swaths of they're all this or they're all that. So
no, and I get the impression that you don't do that, but I am not unlike everybody that I know.
Well, I mean, that's the great middle of America. That's who we need to talk to. Because you know what? When you and I can start having a conversation, and I don't want to get into the slug versus the dam thing now. I'll be glad to entertain it at another time. But when we can get into a real conversation, when we can really start doing that, and it's not just we hate you, you hate us kind of thing, then maybe we'll solve some of these entrenched problems that are threatening both of us.
But isn't that being that philosophy being reinforced by most of the people that are emailing you today who call themselves progressives?
No, but I also have the other side, like you and Tanya, who wrote in, and a lot of progressive and Patricia. Patricia just called in and just talked about being tolerant.
I understand, but me and Tanya don't consider ourselves progressive.
Well, so Patricia did. I get plenty of emails and calls, and I'm going to move on to take some of them, John, from people that support that. It's just that there is, you know, there is, to be truthful, there is, you know, there's an element out there on both sides. All right, John, I wish I didn't let you go, but so soon. I was listening to Mark Levin last night on my way home from a work meeting. You want to talk about our side doing it, that guy is off the charts in the the hate film. I was thinking about that. Just him. I know Mark when I filled in for Alan Combs. He was on the show. And he just is just spewing hatred like you wouldn't believe. At least Rush, I think he's gone off the deep end lately, but he used to kind of make it funny and pull the wool over people's eyes was more of what he did. But Levin is just pure unadulterated. It's not even funny. It's not humor. It's not humor hate. It's just gross. And I think how I could never get out of a radio studio and have that feeling of I just condemned all these. I would feel so terrible about myself. I wouldn't. He said he had high blood pressure, and he was talking about medicine. No, go figure you have high blood pressure. You're sitting there telling all you do is spew hate. So it don't, John, it happens. Trust me. They perfected it. My concern is that the left tries to mimic it because they were successful on radio doing it. And I don't think that's the solution, is to mimic it. I do not. Let's see. We are going to... let's see, Ron in California. Is that where we're going? John's not listening to me. Hi, Ron.
Hey, Nancy. I have to give you credit for being even-handed, but I must disagree with you. And I used to be a Democrat. And I'll tell you what really turned me off to the Democratic Party. First of all, many, many years ago, when we started electing a lot of the Democratic presidents, every time they got elected, they reached their hands in my pockets a little deeper. And under every Republican president, I actually, and I'm middle class, made more money. That was number one. Number two.
Wait, before you, but we can get into an economic argument, Ron, but I got to tell you this. If you go back and look at the presidencies of each of them, the job growth numbers and the economies record during those tenures of each of them over the long haul are so far off the charts. Democrats do better economically. So that's a complete myth. You've lost 40% of your wealth under a Republican George Bush. 40% of the world's wealth evaporated under this president. So when you talk about taxes and these people who are all upset about taxes, you got taxed. This was the secret mother of all tax, because they allowed these companies to go hog wild and with no regulations cause that meltdown. That's more than any incremental tax on the top marginal rate, unless you make over $250,000, than you will ever experience. So right there, you're doing way better with Obama, who's going to fix it and help restore some of your wealth.
Well, no, because I've never made more money in my life than I can show you. What I earned those years versus what I paid in taxes. I'm in straight commission sales, and I'm telling you, under Reagan and Bush, I did much better. I did horrible under Carter. The only people that did well under Carter were people like my mother.
How about Clinton? How about Clinton when we had 22 million new jobs were created and we had the best economic growth since the Depression?
Under Clinton, I made 5% less, and the end of Clinton's term is when the tech.
And you're blaming that, but Ron, see, you know, now you're not, you know, honestly, now you're not making sense. You cannot blame the president. Where's your individual responsibility? You know, you had the best economic climate during the Clinton years. You can't say that if you're a middle-class person, if you didn't do well under Clinton, that's your own fault, Ron, because everyone did well during those years.
You didn't listen to me. Here's what I said. I'm in straight commission sales, so I create my own paycheck.
Yeah.
I paid more taxes by 5% under Clinton than I did under Bush.
Well, then you're at the top marginal tax rate. So you're talking about the income tax bracket, right? Because he raised the top 0.1% tax bracket. So unless you are at the top bracket, he never touched any other bracket. So unless you are at the top bracket... And the reason when he did that, Ron, when he raised that tax bracket, the top 1%, it sent a message to the bond markets that they were serious about deficit control. That's why you had interest rates go down like crazy and the growth that we saw. So unless you are a multimillionaire, you never felt anything but good from the Clinton administration.
No, I made under Clinton.
How much money? How much? What's your salary, sir? No one knows who you are.
Okay, I made under Clinton just approaching $100,000. I paid 5% more. The minute Bush came in, my taxes dropped by 5%. I can show you.
And you lost 40% of your wealth during that time.
I'm sorry, Ron. I'm out of time. 40% evaporated. What's your 401k? Figure it out. Do the math on how well you did. Really, think about it. If you're just thinking about that tax, think of the deficit. Think of what your kids are going to have to pay. Think of the spending that he racked up. And then you're saying because of the top, your one income, the if you fell into that bracket even, that's ridiculous. All right. John's yelling at me, too. 1-888-64-NANCY. Just be mad. Just be angry. Just beat everybody up, even people who agree with me. Just, Is that what we want? Maggie, you got to turn your radio down, first of all, because I didn't hear but hi, Maggie.
Hi, how are you? You know, I'm just calling because it cracks me up, this guy that you just talked to, being a salesperson. First of all, his $100,000 income, he didn't specify whether that was before or after deductions, because when you work for yourself, you get to deduct a lot of stuff that people who work on W-2s do not get to deduct. That's the first thing. And then it always makes me laugh when I hear these people talk about middle class. They're middle class. Well, yeah. I have middle class friends in New Jersey who called themselves middle class, and they lived on the water. They owned boats. They had sent their children to private schools their entire lives, paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for their kids' education, and then they would compare themselves with people who were making, you know, $60,000 a year, $50,000 a year, who were middle class.
Yeah. Well, the average, the median income, I think, is something like $46,000 a year. So if you want the median, as in the middle of the bell curve, it's about $46,000.
So there you go. You're, you're kind of supporting my point. And it upsets me when I hear these people talk about how much money they made and how little taxes they paid, when we know that when you work for yourself, you have to take deduct all of these things that you use when you're working.
Right, and that the you know what, and they hate to say this, Maggie. Thank you for your point. I'm up against my clock here. Hang on, Caroline. That what you fail to realize is that a rising tide does lift all boats, and whether you like it or not, with your rugged individualism, you benefit when this economy, when we're all doing better, when the whole middle class is really doing better, like hasn't happened over the last 8 years, then you're going to make more money no matter where you lie on that spectrum. That whole we need each other thing, that's the way it works, my friend. Sorry to break the bad news to you if you think you've done it all by yourself. I got a really good example of kind of a conversation. I'll give you a real concrete example of the what I'm talking about here on the Nancy Skinner Show today at 1-888-64-NANCY, about changing hearts and minds and being strategic and trying to overcome some hurdles that we faced. Let's take climate change, the issue that got me started in all this, right? What was the problem in getting anything done on it, right? The scientists clearly knew it was going to be a monster of all problems. So the scientists were sounding the warning bells, and Al Gore, and he was just ridiculed and mocked easily by the right, because there wasn't the right alliances that you could ridicule them and you could convince people that it was going to hurt them to do anything about this. And so really what they did is
there's all these front groups who are trying to say that climate change was not real. That they try to confuse the public. It's a very well documented thing in Ross Gelbspan's book, The Heat Is On. And I, as a finance major, always said when we get business on the side of alternative technology, that's one big step in that direction and helps start something called the Chicago Climate Exchange, which is a the first market-based exchange for greenhouse gases that has now become the model for hopefully what will be cap and trade. So that when you get money involved and profit, those business people will be less resistant. Okay, there's one big group we had to tackle, and we're this close from doing it. The other big one that's always been a problem is this the fact that the argument that somehow it would be bad for average working people, that union people, sort of the not the top echelon, but these working people, that there was a balance, and if we were going to help the environment, it would hurt the economy. And they played that so well, and it got to be so common among the almost media. I remember when I ran for office against Barack Obama in the primary, and I was asked, I remember this example specifically. I was asked by a reporter at a debate where I found the balance between the environment and the economy. And they accepted the premise of balance and that doing something on climate change, my signature issue, would hurt the economy. And I answered, I reject your premise completely. And so I said that there is no such thing as balance, that when we start to adopt a whole host of new technologies, we will create a whole new industries, sectors. It'll be the biggest economic boom we will have because these are new technologies that aren't easily shipped overseas. And that was always sort of a PowerPoint for those who opposed action on climate change. So some other folks figured out how to do something a lot more powerful than I in terms of addressing that issue. The Blue-Green Alliance is a national partnership of labor unions and environmental organizations dedicated to expanding the number of green jobs, dealing with climate change, launched by the Sierra Club and the United Steelworkers. Yay, Leo Gerard, back in 2006. They're growing, and they've put these two groups who were heretofore at different ends of this issue together, and they're running ads in states like Indiana, Pennsylvania, and Ohio to bring these people together and sort of deal with that whole issue of the dissonance on climate change. David Foster is the executive director of the Blue-Green Alliance, and he joins me now. I'm so happy, David. I had to set that up because it was so important that people know what you've done is monumental.
Well, terrific. I appreciate that, Nancy, and happy to be with you this afternoon.
Good. Well, great. So, I mean, who actually decided to form this alliance? Who got together with whom? I'm interested in the story.
Well, it's a bit of an untold story with a long history that, in fact, there's been efforts on the part particularly of my old union, the United Steelworkers and the Sierra Club, to work together jointly on issues going back all the way to the Clean Air Act. And the fact is that the steelworkers were always very concerned about the environment because our members inside those hot, dirty, dusty, smoky plants were the first to feel the effects of pollution. We knew it was bad. It was bad for workers' health, and it was bad for the communities that surrounded them. And so we've always had an eye toward believing that environmental reform was helpful for cleaning up the workplace. Mm-hmm. I think what's new is the understanding today that the biggest economic opportunities of the 21st century are going to come through big environmental investments. And it's exactly as you said. It's not a question of jobs versus the environment. It, frankly, is both or neither. And I think that's been borne out by the current recession mm-hmm. and economic yeah. crisis that we're in today, where both are in a terrible fix, and we won't get the jobs without fixing the environment at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that you guys seek to accomplish in terms of, I mean, there is obviously the President Obama has a Green Jobs Initiative, $15 billion a year over the next decade to invest in these jobs of the future. Are you out there to shore up the political support and really make sure, because I'm in Detroit, David, and
right.
I'll tell you I don't see Ron Gettelfinger on your website. And I really think that it's important that you bring the auto workers into this whole mix, because for a long time, you know, the auto workers really bought into that, that somehow any move to improve CAFE standards or whatnot would be detrimental to them personally. And so they helped the companies fight that legislation back.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely think that we're at a nodal point in America today when it comes to thinking about transportation issues. And the future of automotive manufacture in the United States lies with creating a great green automotive industry again that can produce fuel-efficient vehicles, that can produce electric cars, that can produce the next generation of technology. And I think we've learned this over and over again in manufacturing, that when you decide not to advance with the future, to embrace a vision of change that's progressive, you very often get left behind. And in a certain sense, I think the United Auto Workers taught us the lesson of how to build a great middle class out of the technologies of the future when they emerged in the 1930s as the union that represented mass production workers, gave us a standard of living where people could own cars, own homes, send their kids to college. And we're now at another nodal point in our economy where clean energy is going to provide that same locomotive to an economic future that rebuilds manufacturing and rebuilds the middle class in this country.
Right. Well, good. Well, David, let me ask you a sort of an interesting sidebar question to me. And that is because, you know, I think the those who opposed, you know, climate change and clean energy and whatnot, the Rush Limbaughs of the world and such, they could appeal to the sort of your, you know, union worker because they can make it seem like doing those things were sissy-like, and that it's more macho to be, like, driving Hummers. And you know, like Rush today said, a thing I like, Priuses make me laugh because I can eat them up with what I drive. And that's like, there's a machoism to that argument that I can see, you know, it has some resonance. And it's tougher for us on the other side to say, I'm really macho to, like,
let me tell you this, is that a lot of people have had this idea and they like to paint the picture of green jobs as being some weird techno set of employment skills that you have a double PhD in order to be able to perform them, that the average 55-year-old steel worker could never hold one of those because their job skills and the educational level just don't prepare them for that. And one of the things we've tried to demystify is exactly what green jobs are. And I like to say that green jobs are nothing but blue-collar jobs done for a green purpose. And so if Rush Limbaugh thinks that putting together a hybrid automobile is some kind of a weenie job, let him go stand down in a pit with an air wrench and fork and put it together. And if he thinks anything green is sissy, let him get 300 feet up on a wind tower turbine out on Buffalo Ridge in western Minnesota and fix one of those wind turbines that is built with 300 tons of steel. And so the green jobs.
I don't think he could climb up atop of a wind turbine. I don't think we'd want that. You're right about that. That is the same kind of work. It's just for a different purpose. So I know we don't have a whole lot of time, David.
Yeah.
So here's a question I have. We've been focused on what's happening politically now. Obviously, you got an administration that completely agrees cap and trade is the way to go. He says we have to make that investment.
Yep.
You have some conservative Democrats, however, who are saying, well, no, we have to fix the economy first, which is, you know, logic turned up on his head. What are you doing to get to those? Because we could have budget reconciliation. We could push cap and trade through if we were to do that. You've got to be talking to Evan Bayh in Indiana and Blanche Lincoln and some of these people who are holding this up. Are you getting your members? Do you want us and you want your members to talk to them?
We do right now. I think the most important thing we can do to turn the American economy around is talk to our elected representatives about getting climate change legislation passed. Every economic recession we've experienced in this country, we have had to have a leading economic industry to pull us out of that downturn, whether it was the military activity around World War II, whether it was the big housing boom at the end of the war. We need a leading economic industry, and at this time, in this place in history, it's going to be the clean energy transformation. So we need to make those big, bold investments, and if we do that, that's what will bring us out of the current recession, It's the fast, effective, quick way to do it. It relies on the job skills Americans already have. It's not a massive retraining program. It, in fact, is a massive revitalization program. It will put those auto supply parts workers back to work making gears for wind turbines instead of gears for Hummers. It'll put steel workers back to work making plate for wind turbine towers instead of making plate for things that aren't as necessary. It'll be exactly the stimulus that will create long-term stable economic growth. It'll give us manufacturing. It'll give us construction. It'll put Americans back to work.
Without credit default swaps necessary. David, that is a great analogy. What you're doing is what the war and the stimulus of the recovery was that got us back on our feet. This is the industry, the recovery industry of the future. And you put it so well, and this is long overdue, your effort. So come back with us anytime and tell our people what to do, what you want them to do specifically. Call their reps, call everybody, get this thing passed. This is a solution. We really appreciate it. It's bluegreenalliance.org is the website. David Foster, the executive director, is doing the Lord's work out there. Good luck to you, David.
Great. Thank you very much, Nancy. Okay. I'd love to come back sometime.
Anytime. Leo Gerard. I love Leo. We're good friends, and anything he told me to do, man, he's one of the fieriest, smartest men I have ever met. So
great. We all love Leo. He's a great leader.
Yes, we do. Okay, thanks a lot. Great. Alrighty. See, folks, that's what I'm talking about these alliances. If Republicans, Rush could tell those union workers so easily that this is against their interest. And if we just engage in this, them and us, and the self-identification of, well, I'm not a sissy, I'm not a Democrat, whatever, then we're not going to get the steel workers backing climate change legislation. I couldn't have planned this better. If I did, I didn't. You know, that is my point. It's that it's strategery, friends. We ain't going to get where we want to go by just saying them versus us. It won't happen, and then we're all screwed. You want that? No, maybe some people do. I don't.
Mr. D. White Love.
When you woke up this morning, everything was gone. My hands can't stand your head. You're going to take my fingers and come down from your...
Not so much. Not so much today. It is Nancy Skinner, the Nancy Skinner Show, and I'm Nancy Skinner, 1-888-64-NANCY. I'm just sort of reflecting about how great that was to talk. I just interviewed David Foster, who's the executive director over at the Blue Green Alliance. And I'll tell you what, I mean, that is, why is it? There is if you look at the UAW membership, or union membership in general, there's a significant Republican component to that, which always drove me nuts. As a candidate, I would look at these numbers and say, look at, I wonder where these people are now. Because essentially what they're trying to do is destroy the unions. Shelby and Corker and all these people, that a lot of what the gaming that's going on, President Bush did nothing to help the auto industry. A lot of it was about breaking unions. So what and why is it that there was this huge percentage? And I will tell you, I have a strong belief that there has been an effort to build up in the minds of union workers, middle-aged men, a self-identification that somehow it's in your economic interest to be Republican, but also that to be a Democrat was to be a sissy. tell me that that is not true, that there hasn't been some, like, testosterone on the right and estrogen on the left. And so and that hasn't been something that they have tried to manipulate to their benefit. So you would have union workers voting against their own economic interest because somehow it's more macho to be Republican. And, you know, with the Rush Limbaugh persona, I was listening to him today. In the car I drive, I could eat a Prius. You know, I maybe that's not a good example of him as macho. He's not exactly Vin Diesel, but to think that they haven't played on that is silly. They have. There's nothing macho about kind of you being duped if you think you should be against your own economic self-interest because you prefer to be labeled some way. You're not comfortable with how you vote with your inner Democrat. I don't know. But I know that I'm sure this has been studied. The identity politics of Republicans and Democrats and the femininity factor therein. I think that's changing now with everything's changing, but it is what it is, says the good Lord. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the Nancy Skinner program. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. We're going to keep plowing forward with a positive attitude, despite gloomy economic data, especially with the auto industry. I am Nancy Skinner, 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program. All right, what happens when you, say, study 200,000 people over 10 years and see what motivates them and what works and what doesn't in any organization or kind of in life? I would guess, not having seen all of that research, that recognizing people and saying they're doing a good job will help motivate them. Seems obvious, but 65% of people in this country say they've never received any recognition whatsoever, like the auto workers who get heaped upon constantly. This research was pulled together, and this simple premise of how effective recognition could be was published in a book called The Carrot Principle, the New York Times best-selling book. The Carrot Principle, now in its second edition, has some very thoughtful lessons for all of us, even in tough times, especially in tough times, I should say, how to get praise from your boss and keep your job. Chester Elton was a co-author of that New York Times best-selling book, The Carrot Principle, and he's also a business consultant, and he's going to make me feel better about my auto workers who are constantly beaten up by the entire American public and tell you how you can get more out of your employees and get more out of your boss. Hi, Chester. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, a pleasure to be on the show. By the way, that was a great introduction to this whole premise. Good job.
Well, hey, I see what you're doing. See, don't let the blonde hair fool you. You know, I know it seems simple enough. Let's start before we get into. I know that there's a general approach here, but to transition this, I just was just on Fox News and just a little bit. I'm always the one seemingly has to go out there and say, you know, the auto workers are not the bad guys here. They work hard. These, you know, I know these people. They're making $60,000 a year. That is not, a lavish salary when you work as hard as you do, whatnot. But it seems as if they never. Not only do they not get praised, Chester, they have become sort of like almost the kicking, you know, the dog for what's gone on in manufacturing because of it's probably so visible. What would you say to the hardworking men and women who constantly have to hear their jobs, themselves abused, really, in relation to their jobs?
Well, it is tough. When not only do you not get the positive reinforcement, but as you said, you get vilified. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the AIG workers as well, you know, where you had politicians saying, well, we should publish their addresses. I thought, you've got to be kidding me. You know, it's one thing to be in an industry that's in a downturn. And like you say, not for the fault of 95% of the workers that are out there putting in a hard day's work. It is tough. And one of the things we talk about in our book and in our work is that, you know, teams need to buoy each other up. You know, co-workers need to buoy each other up. You need to be the positive person and maybe turn off the TV or, you know, don't look at the front page of the Wall Street Journal for a week or so. And find those positive things within your team and that you like about each other and start building each other up that way. It's a fairly simple thing to do. You know, as you pointed out, Nancy, it's common sense, but it's uncommonly practiced.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we come in, where we teach coworkers, we teach leaders to say, look for the positive. We say create a carrot culture of appreciation and thank yous. Simple little things that your mom taught you, right? But that somehow in the workplace we leave behind.
Well, and it's almost in every relationship. I'll make it more general. When you are in a relationship and someone says, gosh, you look fantastic today, you're more likely to want to look fantastic. If someone, you know, says you're looking kind of dumpy, you're mad and you probably don't care what, you know, I mean, that's the simplest thing I can think of, but that we are human beings who go to the same companies, sure. And the same principles apply.
Well, you know, it's really funny as we do our presentations. So one of the things I love to do, Nancy, is I say, look, I'm going to ask you a personal question. How many of you here are madly in love, or happily married, or both? You know, and you pull up and you say, how do you build a positive relationship? And I'll ask him, you're madly in love. How often do you tell your significant other, your spouse, your husband, your wife, that you love them? And they say, oh, multiple times a day. I said, well, that must get boring. You know,
yeah.
Don't you hate hearing that over and over again? And the fact is, no, you don't. You know, people need that positive affirmation, whether it's at work or in your personal lives. And that's what builds this culture of appreciation. Now, the upside of that is, and this is where our research was wonderful, is that we found that leaders and coworkers that were that way, that were complimentary, that appreciated and valued each other, guess what? They got to their goals faster. They were more profitable. They had higher customer satisfaction scores. So not only is it a nice thing to do as a human, it's a great thing to do in a business. So the business application is proved out time and time again. As you mentioned, over 200,000 surveys over 10 years. The numbers don't lie.
So, but we're not talking about, you know, bearing false witness here, or a lack of integrity. We're talking about, you know, I work in a fairly intense environment with my engineer, John. We're on the air. Things are, if you see, I'm pulling off, running out, ran out of the studio, just did a quick TV hit, came back. I mean, to the minute, it's always tense. And when, so I say, hey, that's great. That's a great song. You pulled that off. Or he gives me a thumbs up on that segment. And it creates the virtuous circle. But I would think, Chester, that people would say, well, you're just making that up. You're just, well, you know, that you can't be disingenuous because it won't have the same effect. And I would agree with that. It has to be something you truly, you know, you believe.
Yeah. And here's what we teach, and this will be great for your listeners. First off, general praise has no impact on people. I mean, if you were just constantly coming in with your engineer and going, hey, you're the best, hey, you're great, hey, love ya. You know, that becomes disingenuous very quickly. But what we
Yeah, and he knows I'd be like lying through my teeth if I did
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Okay. You know, that's the ticket. Remember that guy from Saturday Night Live? Yeah, that's the ticket. But here's what we teach, is that if it's frequent, it's specific, and it's timely, it'll be effective. So in other words, it's frequent in that you're constantly messaging, and you know this from radio, it's all about reach and frequency to your audience. What are you reinforcing that you want repeated? Because rewarded behavior gets repeated. Secondly is, it's specific. The more specific you are, and you just did it right then, you said, hey John, that was great that you found that piece of music, you pulled it off. It wasn't just, hey great, it was, hey great, you found that music. That was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do it right away. And that the closer the recognition is to that desired behavior, the more likely it is to be repeated. So, you know, don't go wandering around with your finger guns blazing going, hey, great job, great job, great job. You know, find out specifically what it is. Do it frequently in a timely way. And that's the ground, that's the building blocks of a lasting relationship, one that's valued, one that is positive.
So let me ask you this. Chester Elton is my guest, the author of The Carrot Principle, and a speaker, a business consultant, speaker on this subject. Yeah, I worked for the governor's husband here, and the governor of Michigan, and he's a big leadership advocate. And they instituted leadership and recognition awards as soon as they took over, imagine 50,000 state employees who never really got recognized. But I do think that there's a risk of when it's a structured once a year, here's an award thing, that it loses what you just mentioned. It loses sort of that authenticity. How does an organization institute this on an institutional basis, but without it being sort of, like the annual banquet where you get the award and
it's funny. You're referencing Dan Mulhern.
Yeah, Dan was his chief of staff.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, I know Dan very well.
Yeah.
And actually, I went up and did some work with the governor and some of her staff and so on around this very issue. Because if you're only, let's go back to our personal relationships. If in your personal relationship you only heard "I love you" at the annual banquet, I don't think you'd be very convincing,
Right.
364 days of the year, I hear nothing once a year. "I love you." Nah, I'm not buying it.
Right.
What we talk about is this day-to-day kind of recognition. And we call it low-cost, high-yield. Very simple little things, like the verbal praise we talked about, that's frequent, specific, and timely, but things that you can do on a daily basis. I'm a big proponent of a handwritten thank you note. And I know it's very retro, and it may seem archaic to some people that, texted me or Twitter.
Great, yeah.
I mean, I think, from your reaction, I'll bet you've received some handwritten.
From Dan Mulhern, I have one in my office, just Nancy. It was great. It's on his little card. It's stationery. And it really says to somebody, and I took the time to write you, this out. It just means a lot more than, especially electronic emails. Emails.
Oh, sure. I mean, nobody prints out an email and frames it, right? But I know people that have gotten handwritten notes from the governor or the president of the company or even your Sunday school teacher, right? And you value it and you put it in your journal or you keep it in a drawer where when times are tough, you kind of pull those things out. This is a great practice, by the way, that a guy shared with me. He's got his Hall of Fame file. And what he does is he takes all these little notes, and he does print out the odd, if the email is particularly, moving to him, puts it in this file. And then when he's having a tough day, he goes in and pulls out that note, in your case, like from Dan Mulhern, and say, "Hey, on that day, I didn't stink." there was one time when I actually was pretty good at my job. Somebody valued me, and it worked out great. And I think that's important.
Well, that's an important mindset, Chester, because whenever you're really in the tank, as so many people are right now, with the economy and their fear and anxiety. In fact, I had my makeup artist today, and she said, we were talking about a situation, and she said, what I always try to do is I try to think the worst possible thing that could happen, and then I avoid it. He said, Robin, that's bad thinking. I said, what you should think of is what the best possible outcome is and think about that happening. And, in another way, it's like, it's sometimes when you're really in the tank, Chester, it's hard to think of it. So if you can pull that one day out where you were good,
Absolutely. Or
that one moment and latch onto that, then you're going to start to feel better. You're pulling yourself gradually out of the muck.
You bet. Now, here's another great practice, and you'll love this, and we've all got this. I've actually got a great friend who wrote a book called The Power of Who, and he talks about, working your network of your friends, and who's your best friend, and then your three other best friends, and then your 12. I laugh at him because he says, 12 good friends. Hey, it worked for Jesus. It'll work for you, too. So what we do, and I've actually done this, and it works great, and particularly for a lot of your auto worker friends out there that are really in tough times. When you really have a tough time, think of those two or three really positive people in your life and call them up. I did this the other day. I was having just a hellacious day. Planes were late. Things were going wrong. I called my good friend John McVeigh, and I said, "John, it's Chester." He says, "Hey, what's up?" I said, "Tell me I'm great." He says, "Having a tough day?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Chester, you're great. Nobody's greater than you. You're the best." I said, "Thanks, bro. I needed that."
Yeah, I do it all the time. And sometimes if you don't have that person handy by, you just got to tell yourself that. Because what they're going to say, right? To say, "You know what? I don't look fat today at all. In fact, I look great. Darn it." And I was funny on that. Hey, Chester, when we come back, I just want to, if you will, share some thoughts with people that are going through really, really tough times. Fear of losing their job. It's all makes common sense, but when you layer on top of that tremendous anxiety and fear about your situation and your finances and everything else. That's the question I'm going to ask you is, how do people get through these tough times using the Carrot Principle? Okay, great. He'll hang on. Chester Elton, if you want to call in, do so as well. 1-888-64-NANCY. Chester Elton, the Carrot Principle. Best New York Times best-selling book, really. I know about it from Dan. Dan, I think he's had it on his website. Really good timing for you, Chester, after what we've been talking about all day with the auto industry all week. So for months, actually. So we will end on a good note on the Nancy Skinner Show. Place in the middle of nowhere with a big black horse and a cherry tree. Woo-hoo. Now I won't come back because it's all so happy and now I got a hole for the world to see. Alright, a carrot a day helps keep the pink slips away. I just made that up on the spot. How was that, Chester? Chester Elton is my guest. He is the co-author of The Carrot Principle, carrots.com. This is beyond a book, a best-selling book. It's you can get training in it. There's all kinds of things. I'm sorry, I asked you a question. I didn't even have you up, Chester. I was trying to get my praise, and I was soliciting, and I didn't get it.
I know. I even said how much I love that little line, and I'd probably use it in my next speech.
Go for it. It's yours. I want to talk about that because people are going through the pink slip fear. But, you know, as I was during the break, just going through your website a little bit, it seems to me that President Obama is employing the Carrot Principle on an international scale. When he went and said what he did to the Muslim world, when he went out with all those and talked to the Europeans about sometimes we haven't been, you know, we've had our attitude hasn't been right. I think what he's trying to do is use the Carrot Principle. We're going to get a lot more than out of cooperation on the issues we care about with carrots rather than sticks.
Well, I think you're right. And I think it's, you know, he's been criticized because he didn't get all the results he wants. But this takes time. You just don't flip a switch. You know, I was very impressed. There was a comment where, you know, he was trying to put through the stimulus package and he was continually talking to the Republicans and trying to get this, you know, coalition together. And people said, listen, President, you've got the bully pulpit. You were just elected. Just make him do it. And he said something I thought was very telling. And he said, you know, never underestimate the power of common courtesy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if that's the direction we're going, I'm all for it. You know, dialogue. We yell at each other so much. We don't listen. And you know, one of the things that we found around engagement and so on is that you had to have this sense of well-being. You know, that people cared about you. You had to have trust and you had to have pride in the place where you work. So we looked at that and said, what are the drivers of those? Well, appreciation was a major driver in every one of those.
Mm-hmm.
You build trust through appreciation and doing what the president is trying to do. You know, you build a sense of well-being by coming to work and finding people there that value you and build you up.
Because you're spending an awful lot of your life, the minutes, those breaths that are numbered, in your workplace. So even, it's not just about, I would say this to anybody, it's not just about getting that paycheck. It's about how you're spending your life, the quality of your time, and if you employ these simple techniques, you're going to be a happier person during those 8 hours or 10 hours or 12 hours right now that you're whatever.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, it's beyond just how to get the next promotion or the next raise or not get fired. It's about you're alive now. That moment, once that breath is gone, how did you spend it?
Right. You know, my dad was a great advocate of just, you know, living a positive life. And he taught me a great lesson one time when he literally helped a homeless woman whose belongings had spilled out on the street. And he ran right over to her, picked up all her stuff, got her safely in the park. And I remember being a little kid and telling him, hey, Dad, you're not supposed to touch those people. They're not clean, you know. And he said something I'll never forget. He said, you know, Chess, you be good to everybody. Everybody's having a tough day. And to your point, you know, when we go to work with our coworkers, we don't know what situation they've come from. If there's abuse in the family or a troubled child or disease or illness or whatever. But here's what we do know. When our coworkers show up and the people that work with and forth, when they show up to our place, we can make them feel great. And when they feel better about themselves and where they work, they're going to be more productive. I think more and more businesses have to look to their people to pull them out of these tough times. We're all, you know, looking for a stimulus package or this or that or the other thing. Hey, you know what? Let's pull each other out of this. That common courtesy that makes so much sense but is uncommonly practiced. And let's be the ones. You know, you were asking me, how can I avoid the pink slip? Well, you know what? Be that positive person at work. Don't be the gossip. Be the one that builds people up. Be that person that when people are down, they want to call you as a pick-me-up. And that's going to create a better position for you in your workplace and a better workplace for your entire team.
Mm, and it is. It's the human capital that you're so right, Chester, that I think we have to be looking more and more, too, as, you know, if it's just a race to the bottom in terms of cheap wages, we're not going to win that one.
No, you know, you can always find something for less. Let's create, you know, products and services where people want to go because the value add is so high that you wouldn't think of going anywhere else.
Right, because we all make choices as consumers, too.
You bet.
And that's, you know, so put your money where your mouth is. Well, this is this was very timely, let's put it this way, because it's been one of those hairy days for me, too, and for Detroit and for the auto industry, Chester. So it was great timing, and probably not coincidental.
No, well, listen, be good to everybody. Everybody's having a tough day. And for great tips, I mean, it's carrots.com, but seriously, you don't have to buy the book. Just start being good to each other.
Well, that's great. Well, thanks for being good to us, Chester Elton. We appreciate it so much.
Thank you.
You rock, Chester. I'll bet.
You too.
Okay. All right, you bet. Take care. Thanks so much. There we go. And then John ends on my positive note, right? My favorite song. So can we gain my Zen-like center after yelling and screaming on Fox News all day? Oh, my people. Well, thank you. That was well put. And then tomorrow we'll come back and we'll do it all over again. How's that? Deal? On the Nancy Skinner Show.